For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, so we're in Luke chapter 12, and we're talking about a life worth living. The context here is Jesus has been teaching a lot. He's well into his ministry at this point, okay? He's been having a lot of conversations, doing a lot of service, healing a lot of people, having a lot of confrontations with religious rulers. But he's well into his ministry, and he's becoming an increasingly polarizing figure. And what I mean by that is people are coming to conclusions about him that are really widespread. Either he is a villain, a threat to the religious system, a false teacher, and someone who needs to be killed, or he's God. And he's a figure that really doesn't allow for this middle ground that he's just a really nice guy, he's just a really good teacher, he's just a wise man. As people interact with him more and more, and as they hear him more and more, they kind of get funneled into one of these two camps, depending on their heart attitude towards him and towards God. And at the heart of what Jesus is doing, at the heart of his teaching, is this real important point that God is not what you seem to think that he is. You know, the culture that Jesus was in tended to see God as sort of like this this grumpy man in the sky who would judge them if they took a misstep. If they didn't follow the rules and didn't follow the laws and didn't follow the rituals, that God would strike out at them in vengeance. And that if they did follow the rules and they did do what God said that he wanted, that he would bless them. And Jesus comes in and he really turns that on his head and says, you know what, the problem is that there's no such thing as a good person. There are no good people. There's only God and sinful people that God loves and wants to forgive and wants to move towards in mercy. But in order for us to be forgiven, we have to come to a place of faith where we are willing to admit that we have problems, that we cannot keep God's law, and that we need mercy. And so he taught them about this, and he emphasized the importance of a personal relationship, a connection with God. And he spent his time with sinners, with tax collectors, with prostitutes, and with the people who knew that their lives were headed in the wrong direction. And his message was to the Pharisees that we read about last time, to the religious rulers of his day, you're in danger of living your entire life. Your whole purpose and the things that you live for, you could be living for the wrong things. And you could come to the end of your life and realize all this time and all this energy that you've devoted to these religious observances were not what God wanted. And so it raises an important question, a question that the Bible is all about. What is the key to a full life? The concept behind this Bible of ours, in a big way, is that we have a creator. Someone made you. And they made you with intent. It wasn't just, you know, a haphazard throwing together of stuff and, you know, God was in a laboratory somewhere mixing chemicals and just seeing what would happen. But that he had an idea, a concept. He wanted to make beings that reflected his image, that were a representation of himself, and he wanted to have relationships with them. He wanted community. And so he created these beings, and he gave them the most incredible power in the universe, which is choice. An all-powerful God made and formed man in his own image and says, now I give you the power to tell me no. Because I want to have a love relationship with you. And if I don't do that, then you're automatons, you're robots, you're just carrying out a preordained program. I give you a will. And the reason that he made us is for relationship, not just with him, but with each other. We were made, we were built for love, for community, for closeness with him and with each other. But we rebelled. And we moved away from God. And we used that free will to become our own gods. And since then, it's been a lot more about how can I find fulfillment for myself, and how can I get what I want? And that's what's brought the pain and suffering of this world together. And now we're confused. Now we're confused, and we're living our lives, and we're asking ourselves, what do I need? How can I be happy? And we come up with silly conclusions like this. The American dream. The idea that, you know, each generation will somehow make itself more financially solvent, have more resources, more power, and more comfort at their disposal than the last generation. A system, an idea, a dream that is based only on the material things of this world. Some of us find other variants and other ways of getting confused. We think, well, you know, if I could just find the right person to marry. When we spend our lives looking for the person who's going to make us feel full and whole and fulfilled. And it's too much to ask of a person because we were made to be whole and to be fulfilled and to be content through a relationship with our Creator. And no person can fill that hole. And so we go through marriage after marriage and relationship after relationship, looking for that thing, looking for that contentment and that fulfillment. For some of us, we think, we get the idea that it's money. You know, if I can just get enough. But see, enough is a moving target, isn't it? What was enough 10 years ago isn't enough now, is it? And so we devote our lives to trying to pad the nest and try to get as much of a buffer between the pain and suffering of this world and our lives as we can, and we do it with dollar bills, hoping that we can improve our lives, make ourselves full, and someday have enough. Some people, it's not specifically about money, it's just about comfort. It's about avoiding the pain and suffering of this world. What is the secret to a full life, to a content life, to a happy life? Our Creator knows, because He knows what He made us for. And that's what this passage is really about in a lot of ways. God has some radically challenging thoughts. His thoughts are not our thoughts on this. And He challenges us, and we would do well to listen to this. So we get to Luke chapter 12, and we start in verse 13. And Jesus is out teaching, like He normally teaches. And someone in the crowd pipes up and says, "Hey, teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." And Jesus says to him, "Man, who appointed me judge or arbitrator over you?" And then He said to them, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." Now, this is interesting on a number of fronts. We have to remember that Jesus' role in this culture is a rabbi, okay? And rabbis were often called on to make judgments between family members. You know, if you had a conflict or something going on, you know, you might take your family member or your neighbor or your friend to the rabbi and be like, "Rabbi, you know, we have an argument here. We need someone to solve it for us." And the rabbi would be able to choose. But the man's really not asking Jesus to be very arbitrary, is he? He's not saying, "My brother and I have a conflict about this inheritance. We want you to settle it." He's saying, "Jesus, tell my brother to give me my stuff." And Jesus rejects that. He's like, "That sounds like something I don't want to be in the middle of. I'm not going to choose sides on this. No, thank you." What He does instead, though, is He addresses the root of the issue that is probably existing between this man and his brother. And it's a very interesting, Jesus is so interesting in the wisdom and in the way that He approaches these issues. The man says, "Lord, tell my brother what to do." And Jesus instead says this, "Be on your guard against every form of greed." What He points to is not the issue of the inheritance directly, but the issue of what's going on in the man's heart. And He raises a very good, a very valid question. Essentially, what He says to the man is, which is more important to you, your inheritance or your relationship with your brother? Obviously, the two brothers are in conflict. Is it going to help the relationship with the brother if Jesus comes in and does as the man says and says, "Look, I'm a rabbi, you will give him half"?
So instead, Jesus raises this and creates this tension in this situation.
If you had to choose between that inheritance and your brother, which would you choose? And this question gets to the heart of an important question, going back to the issue of what fulfills us and what makes us whole and what gives us a good life.
What's more likely to give this man a good life? Half the inheritance or good relationship with his family, with his brother?
You see, money and relationships, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. We don't mean to say if you're rich, you can't have relationships, you know, or if you're poor, you're going to have a ton of relationships. That's clearly not true. But what Jesus is talking about here in the context of this is that by making money more important than your relationships, you are doomed to fail at life. When you make money more important than relationships, you are doing something that is against the nature, against the very purpose for which you were created.
And you might be like, yeah, everybody agrees with that. We all have seen, you know, A Christmas Carol, and we all know Ebenezer Scrooge and, you know, the three spirits. And yes, relationships are more important than money. Yes, we agree with that, and we live that out.
But, you know, there's a lot of times where we're faced with decisions that pertain directly to this question of values. What is more important to you, relationships or money? And we don't even realize it. We don't even think it. We don't even think about it. And we choose money. How many hours a week are you willing to work? That is a direct question of what is more important to you in life. Relationships or money? And now, you know, I know that people will say, well, I have to work 70 hours a week. I wouldn't have a job. You wouldn't have a job, or you wouldn't have the income that you say that you need or that you think that you need now in order to be able to do the things that you want to do. We make decisions all the time. You know, if you want to work 70 hours, 80 hours a week, you are sacrificing relationships. Whether it be with your spouse, with your children, with your friends, with your neighbors. And if you do that and you live your life for that, you're going to have a lot of money and a lot of nothing else. And God's point, Jesus' point here to this man is, this will leave you empty, depressed, and sad. How much do you travel? How much do you have to be away from home? How many days a week? How many weeks a year do you have to be out on the road? That's something that you really, as in taking a job and having a career, need to think about. You know, and people say, well, you know, I have to do this. I have to make this much. And it's like, you have to make this much. You have to make X amount of dollars because you've chosen X amount of expenses. You chose the house that you chose. You chose the car that you chose. You have the payments and the things that you chose because you wanted those things, and then you feel trapped. You feel like you don't want to work this much. You don't want to have to travel this much. You don't want to be away from your kids this much. But what are you going to do? Sell the stuff and simplify your life and make relationships the most important thing. Be on guard, Jesus says. You know, people a lot of times, you know, they get into a career, they're moving forward, and the boss comes along and they're like, Johnson, I need you to move to Albuquerque. You're like, well, my kids are rooted here. I have a church and a community and friends, and I've got family here. And if I don't do this, if I don't move, I'm going to lose my job. That is a question of what is more important and what is more valuable to you, relationships or money. Now, we don't always necessarily answer that question in the same way. But it's an important values question that flies directly in the face of this materialistic demon that Jesus is trying to warn us against. How much emotional resources are you willing to expend in the pursuit of money? Maybe you don't work a ton of hours. Maybe you don't travel all the time. Maybe you just hate your job so much, or it is so taxing for you that by the time you get to the end of the day, you've got nothing left to give anyone, and you just are going to have to just lie on the couch and tell the kids to go play Legos and tell the wife,
you know, I can't do it. I don't have it in me. Now, maybe that's an issue of resources and management and time management and all those other things. Or maybe you need a different job. The question is whatever it takes to be there, to be available, not just bodily present, but engaged relationally with friends and family and neighbors, is what you should make the higher priority in your life. That is choosing the better part. The better part of life is love and relationship. And I know that you know this, but I don't know that all of us are living this. And it's so important. Jesus says, be on guard. Be ready. Be on guard against greed. Meaning throughout your life, a constant and regular thought that should come into your head is, how am I doing with the greed thing? Like, we never reach a point where it's like, I have conquered greed. I used to struggle with that. It was horrible. But now it's so much better. I'm glad that got fixed. No, it's a lifelong struggle. And being on guard means watching, protecting your life and your family and your relationships from your greed. And he says this fascinating thing. Not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. Even the richest people that you can imagine, the richest people you can think of, are much more valuable than the sum of their stuff. Your stuff does not define you. He who has the most toys does not win. It is much deeper than that. You are much more valuable than that. You are a fearfully and wonderfully made being in the image of the Creator God of the universe. You're so much more important than your stuff. Yet we struggle to believe it. We live in a fog. We look at things and we think, you know, and it's thrown at us all the time through advertising and everything else. Your car is a projection of who you are. No car could be made that would even come close to the glory that God has instilled in you. The spiritual truth, the reality of life, of who you are and what you represent, no machine could even come close to being a fair representation of who you are. Yet we think what we wear, the clothes that we buy, the house that we live in, and the car that we drive are all reflections. They're somehow statements about who we are. And we're lost, and we're broken, and we're medicated and alone because we have lost the understanding, the basic core understanding of who it is that God created us to be. We are so much more than the sum of our stuff. Yet we allow the acquisition of things, the accumulation of things, to rule our hearts and to be the deciding factor in so many of life's important decisions. We can never be filled up, never be satisfied with material possessions, because God has not made us that way. Now, you'd look at American culture and you'd say, God made man to be a consumer, right? Because we've got that down. We got that down to an art. We were all ninja masters of consumerism. But that's a result of that rebellion, of that rejection of God's way, of using that free will to become our own God. We are supposed to be givers, not consumers. Creators, not destroyers. We are supposed to be people who find the deepest satisfaction, the greatest joy, and the greatest expression of our own wholeness by taking something that we made and giving it to someone else who needs it. God says, when you do that, you are being who it is that you were made to be. And you can never find contentment, never find anything that comes close to filling that up as a lifestyle, competing with that, because that is who we are supposed to be. But instead, so many of us in the world, not just in America, waste our lives pursuing stuff. Then we get to Luke 12, 16. This is traditionally called the parable of the rich fool. I think I've got a better title. I think it's the parable of the American dream. I think this is, the rich fool is us. It's me. And it's you. And this story is about what's going on in our culture in a big way. So let's start here in 16. It says, and he told them a parable. So he's made the statement to the brother, you know, be on guard against greed. And now he's going to get into a little more detail. He's going to do a little more education on the topic. And so he tells them a parable and he says, the land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? And then he said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God shows up and says to him, you fool. This very night your soul is required for you, of you. And now, who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. I mean, it's a very simple concept, a very simple story. But America, are we listening? Are we thinking about what it is that this is saying? He's saying God calls this man a fool. One thing I would draw your attention to is look here at all the me's and mine's and I's that are in this man's dialogue with himself. You know, 11 times in like three verses, he has this, you know, what shall I do since I have no place? What will I do with my crops? I will tear down my barns. Mine. Such a powerful concept. There is a creator God of the universe who owns and created all things. And yet he has imbued you and me with the concept of mine. Now he says it's on loan. We say it belongs to us. And there's a point of contention there. But think about this. Think about human nature. If you've got kids, you know just as well as I do. Your kids were so sweet. Their first word was mama. And then it was dada. And then it was no and mine. Those were that was number three and number four, wasn't it? What is that? That's the fall. That's the darkness that now exists in the human heart. Mine. I'm going to draw a line. What a powerful concept. You know, your 1.5-year-old understands I can draw a line. And there are two things in this world. There's what's mine and there's what's not mine. And I want more on my side of the line than on your side of the line. And that's the human predicament. And that's what this man is doing. He's looking at this and he's saying, this is mine and I'm going to worry about me and mine. And God shows up to personally inform this man that he's a fool. In the parable here, this guy devoted his life to a lie. That he could somehow be fulfilled. He could somehow be content. He could somehow be whole by what? Working hard, making some shrewd business practices, putting a lot away and storing it up so that he could kick back, relax, and enjoy his life. And God says, you have lived for a lie and you're a fool. A lie that destroys millions of lives. Has destroyed millions and is going to go on to destroy millions of people live for this lie and they die unfulfilled and bitter. That is the lot of one who lives a life devoted to the accumulation of things. Because it's not what we were made to do. And we must believe this. This man's hard work, his blood, sweat, and tears, his wise business practices, all amounted for nothing. Because why? Because we all die. Our time here on earth is limited. And he devoted his life to all of these things, and now he was never going to be able to enjoy it. And God says, don't be a fool. What was the end goal? What was the heart of what this man wanted? Why did he do all this hard work? He said it right here. I want to take my ease and I want to eat, drink, and be merry. That sounds good, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound just like the American dream? Doesn't that just sound like what retirement is supposed to be for most of us? Isn't that what we're supposed to be living for? Aren't we supposed to be working hard at jobs that we might hate? Sacrificing relationships with our spouses and with our children? So why? So that at one day, after working so hard and storing everything up and setting everything up the right way, we could take our ease and eat, drink, and be merry? God says, you're a fool if you do that. You're a fool. Because you don't know how much time you have here on this earth, and you were not created. You were not made for stuff. You were made for love. You were made for relationship. And when you choose this rat race of accumulation of things over relationship, you choose a terrible part. You choose something that's doomed to leave you unfulfilled. Look again at what he says. You fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Be rich towards God, he says. Life is precious. You are an amazing person, an amazing thing. Your Creator loves you and formed you in a way that you can accomplish great things in the field of relationship and giving. And that's what our precious time here on earth is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about love. Love, family, getting to know God, neighbors, and friendships. Because these bodies that we have, these fleshly bags, these soul containers are temporary. They're all going to die. They're all going to pass away. But you are more than the sum of your physical parts. And the soul, the spirit, the spiritual aspect of who you are continues on in eternity. Your personality, your memories, your thoughts, your experiences go on and never die. And so relationships that you build, truths that you learn, things that shape and mold who you are and who other people are the only things of real value because they are the only things that move on into the next life, into eternity. Your body doesn't go with you. Your bank account doesn't go with you. Your cars, your clothes, none of that goes with you. It all turns to dust and falls to the ground. But your relationships do. Your soul does. Your heart does. Your memories and experiences do. And so it's just good investment practices to store up for yourself and to invest yourself in eternity. And things that can never be destroyed. These are the only things that last. So he says, be rich towards God. Live a life of truth, a full life, a meaningful life from the eternal perspective, mindful and remembering the things that carry on into eternity. A lot of people figure this out, actually, but far too many figure it out at the end. So they're dying in their bed, in their 80s and their 90s, and they're reflecting back over life. Apparently, and it makes sense, things get a little more clear about what really matters and what really has value in life. I did a lot of research for this, and I was trying to find something that was like a poll or some kind of statistical gathering of what do people say when they are about to die? What do they say about regret? What do they say about what they wish? And you know how amazingly difficult it is to find stuff on that? It's like a totally taboo thing, you know. It's like, it seems really obvious to me, at least if I were a psychologist, that'd be a pretty important field. I think there should be an entire field of studying what people think right before they die. Only thing I was able to find was a blog that has become really popular, and this woman changed her blog into a book. She's a palliative care nurse. She works with people at the end of their life. This is not from a Christian perspective. I don't mean to endorse this. But I thought it was so interesting, and I wanted to share with you what she saw, what she found in her time as she spent a lot of time with a lot of people in their last moments. Her name is Bronnie Ware. She says, "For many years, I worked in palliative care. My patients were those who had gone home to die. Some incredibly special times were shared. I was with them for the last 3 to 12 weeks of their lives. When questioned about any regrets they had or anything they would do differently, common themes surfaced again and again. Here are the most common 5. One, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. This was the most common regret of all. When people realize that their life is almost over and look back clearly on it, it is easy to see how many dreams have gone unfulfilled. Most people had not honored even half of their dreams and had to die knowing that it was due to choices they had made or not made." Now, that one makes me a little sad to think that people come to their end of their life and they're like, "I just wish I'd been more selfish." It doesn't surprise me, understanding human nature. But that's the number one thing. Okay, fair enough. Number two, "I wish I didn't work so hard." This came from every male patient that I nursed. They missed their children's youth, their partner's companionship. Women also spoke of this regret, but as most were from an older generation, many of the female patients had not been breadwinners. All of the men I nursed deeply regretted spending so much of their lives on the treadmill of a work existence. You know what we've got coming for us as a bonus? Is we'll have an equal number of men and women who have this regret. That's progress. Three, "I wish I had the courage to express my feelings." Many people suppress their feelings in order to keep peace with others. As a result, they settled for a mediocre existence and never became who they were truly capable of being. Many people developed illnesses related to the bitterness and resentment they carried as a result. Number four, "I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. Often they would not truly realize the full benefits of old friends until their dying weeks, and it was not always possible to track them down. Many had become so caught up in their own lives that they had let golden friendships slip by over the years. There were many deep regrets about not giving friendship the time and effort that they deserved. Everyone misses their friendships, their friends, when they are dying." And number five, "I wish I had let myself be happier." This is a surprisingly common one. Many did not realize until the end that happiness is a choice. They had stayed stuck in old patterns and habits. The so-called comfort of familiarity overflowed into their emotions as well as their physical lives. Fear of change had them pretending to others and to themselves that they were content, when deeply within they longed to laugh properly and have silliness in their life again. There's a lack of contentment, there's a lack of fullness, and there's a lot of regret because we're living for stuff and we were made to live for love. I think that's so clear in reading these things and thinking about the tragedy that is happening right now, you know, in the lives of so many people. They're dying, only realizing at the end what life was really all about. What a tremendous gift. What a tremendous opportunity we have right now to grab a hold of this truth and to live it forward. Not to brush it off and not to say, "Well, yeah, I believe all that, and once I make X numbers of dollars, that will be what I'm about." No, that's the point. The point is that this has to start now. Maybe you're here and you're 25, you're 30. Man, you could live your life for relationships and love and come to the end of your life with no regrets. Maybe you're older. Maybe you're in your 50s, 60s, or 70s. You've got life left to live. You've got things to build, relationships to connect with. It's never too late to start living for the right things and to experience the fulfillment that God wants for you. It's so important, though, that we not let this simple truth fly under our radar or give it the casual nod, "Yes, that's very true," and then go on living exactly to the opposite of this truth. Jesus goes on in Luke 12:22, and he said to his disciples after he finishes this parable, "For this reason I say to you, do not worry about your life as to what you will eat,
nor for your body as to what you will put on. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. That's a great challenge. I think Jesus was fully aware of the challenge. You know, he's acknowledging we do have physiological needs, but a life in the primary pursuit of those physical needs and in neglect of relationships is a life wasted. Our Creator is telling us something super important here about who we are. Don't waste your life living for stuff. And he goes on in Luke 12, 24, and he elaborates on all of this. Consider the ravens, he says. For they neither sow nor reap. They don't plant anything. They don't harvest anything. They have no storeroom or barn, and yet God feeds them. How much more valuable you are than birds. And which of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his lifespan? America, are you listening? How much by worrying can you add a single hour to your life? And what are the things that we worry about? What are the things that put a knot in your gut that make you wake up at night gasping for air? Are we safe? Are we provided for? Are we healthy? Are we advancing? How am I going to pay my bills? He says, let go. Let go of that. If then you cannot do even a very little thing, why do you worry about other matters? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. But I tell you, not even Solomon in his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass in the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, how much more will he clothe you, you men of little faith? And do not seek what you will eat and what you will drink, and do not keep worrying. For all these things the nations of the world eagerly seek, but your Father knows that you need these things. But seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. God's critique on the world. The nations of men, the kingdoms of men, run around and scurry around in their short time here on earth. For what? To do what? To accumulate stuff, and then they die and they take none of it with them. And they worry and they kill and they steal and they pillage and they do all of these things for stuff. And it's a life wasted. Instead, seek the kingdom of God and trust that God will be able to meet your needs. So he agrees that we do have needs. The point here is not, you don't need food and clothing. No, he's not saying that. He's saying, don't let food and clothing rule your life. Choose the better part. You see, the main enemy here is fear. Notice how many times in that passage, in that section, he said, don't worry. Let go of your worry. Because it's fear that drives us to create a bigger and bigger buffer between us and potential starvation, right? I mean, that's the concept. How many people in America starved to death last year against their own will? The answer is zero. Now, I don't bring that up because I don't think, I know that we have a hunger problem in the United States. And I know that we have a poor with us, and that God's heart is for the poor, and that we should be reaching out to them and giving to them. But I want you to think for a moment, if we really get down to brass tacks, okay, what would it take for you and your family to go without food, clothing, or shelter? How many things and systems would have to break down? I mean, I know it would be embarrassing and horrible to go bankrupt, and it would be irresponsible, and you know, there's a lot of life's comforts that you would lose. But seriously, consider with me for a moment what it would take for you to go without food, clothing, and shelter in your life. With the friends, family, connections, with the wealth in this country, with the social systems, what would it take? I would argue that it would be virtually impossible if there was any willingness on your part whatsoever to seek help. It would be virtually impossible for you to starve to death. Yet how much anxiety in your life is centered around this question of what am I going to do if I lose the house? What am I going to do if my life falls apart?
And Jesus' point is, take the eternal perspective here. It's not, his point is not, don't work hard, become a bum, and live on the street. That is not his point. But his point is don't live a life of fear, and don't let that fear drive you to the insanity of materialism. Greed is also a great enemy. It's fun to get stuff. It's fun to have more stuff than other people. It's just not fulfilling. It's a temporary, fleeting pleasure that winds up being a soul-crushing millstone around your neck. Another great enemy here is just a lack of spiritual understanding, a lack of knowing, a lack of apprehending and connecting with this truth. A lot of people don't know that this is true. They spend their lives wondering what does matter, what's important in this life. And they struggle to understand that and figure it out, and they can't. All they need is someone to come along and explain this and to roll this out in a way that makes sense and to see it lived out in the lives of other people. And of course, there's excess. A great enemy in our culture, where we live in a culture that's so inundated with stuff, a lot of times we can't even see. We can't even see clearly how wealthy and how much excess we actually have. It's a great question, how much is enough? I want to share with you another article. This one's from the New York Times. Again, a secular perspective based off of scientific research. This is not coming from a Christian perspective. I don't agree with all of it. I don't endorse all of it. I just think it's interesting and worth sharing. This is from the New York Times. Many of us aren't satisfied with how much we have now. That's why we're constantly wrangling for a raise at work, befriending aged relatives, and springing, despite long odds, for lottery scratch tickets. Is it a crazy question to ask how much money you need to be happy? The notion that money can't buy happiness has been around for a long time, even before yoga came into vogue. But it turns out that there is a measurable connection between income and happiness. Not surprisingly, people with a comfortable living standard are happier than people living in poverty. The catch is that additional income doesn't buy us any additional happiness on a typical day once we reach that comfort standard. The magic number that defines this comfortable standard varies across individuals and countries, but in the United States, it seems to fall somewhere around $75,000. Using Gallup data collected from almost 500,000 Americans, researchers at Princeton University found that higher household incomes were associated with better moods on a daily basis. But the beneficial effects of money tapered off entirely after the $75,000 mark. Why then do so many of us bother to work so hard so long after we have reached an income level sufficient to make most of us happy? One reason is that our idea about the relationship between money and happiness is misguided. In research we conducted with a national sample of Americans, people thought that their life satisfaction would double if they made $55,000 instead of $25,000. More than twice as much money, twice as much happiness. But our data showed that people who earned $55,000 were just 9% more satisfied than most making $25,000. 9% beats 0%, but it's still kind of a letdown when you were expecting 100% return. Interestingly and usefully, it turns out that what we do with our money plays a far more important role than how much money we make. Imagine three people each win $1 million in the lottery. Suppose one person attempts to buy every single thing he has, every single thing he has ever wanted. One puts it in the bank and uses the money only sparingly for special occasion, and one gives it all away to charity. At the end of the year, they would all report an additional $1 million of income. Many of us would follow the first person's strategy, but the latter two winners are likely to get the bigger happiness bang for their buck. We usually think of having more money as allowing us to buy more and more stuff we like for ourselves, from bigger houses to fancier cars to better wine to more finely pixelated televisions. But these typical spending tendencies, buying more and buying for ourselves, are ineffective at turning money into happiness. A decade of research has demonstrated that if you insist on spending money on yourself, you should shift from buying stuff, TV and cars, to experiences, trips, and special evenings out. Our own research shows that in addition to buying more experiences, you're better served in many cases by simply buying less and buying for others.
Huh. Way to go, world system.
It's kind of shocking. But the science bears out a lot of what Jesus is saying here, isn't it? A lot of what the Bible tells us. It's about relationship. It's about love. It's not the economy, stupid. It's the relationship, stupid. It's about moving in and connecting with people and having rich experiences and lives and using what stuff you do have to build a life with a community of people. Not the other stuff. I got another story, another thing I want to read to you. This was something my wife found. She'd be mad if I didn't give her credit. This is a real interesting story. This is an adaptation of a short story by a German named Harold Bull. It's been translated into English and changed somewhat, but it's been floating around the internet, and it also fits really well with what we're talking about. So let me just read this for you. An American businessman took a vacation to a small coastal Mexican village on doctor's orders. Unable to sleep after an urgent phone call from the office the first morning, he walked out to the pier to clear his head. A small boat with just one fisherman had docked, and inside were several large yellowfin tuna. The American complimented the Mexican on the quality of his fish. "How long did it take you to catch them?" the American asked. "Only a little while," the Mexican replied, in surprisingly good English. "Why don't you stay out longer and catch more fish?" the American asked. "I have enough to support my family and give to a few friends," the Mexican said as he unloaded them into a basket. "But what do you do with the rest of your time?" The Mexican looked up and smiled. "I sleep late, I fish a little, I play with my children, I take a siesta with my wife, Julia, and I stroll into the village each evening where I sip wine and play guitar with my amigos. I have a full and busy life, senor." The American laughed and stood tall. "Sir, I am a Harvard MBA, and can I help you? You should spend more time fishing. And with the proceeds, buy a bigger boat. In no time, you could buy several boats with the increased haul. Eventually, you would have a fleet of fishing boats." He continued, "Instead of selling your catch to a middleman, you would sell directly to the consumer, eventually opening your own cannery. You would control the product, processing, and distribution. You would need to leave this small coastal fishing village, of course, and move to Mexico City, then to Los Angeles, eventually to New York, where you could run and expand an expanded enterprise with proper management." The Mexican fisherman asks, "But senor, how long will all this take?" To which the American replied, 15, 20 years, tops. "But what then, senor?" The American laughed and said, "That's the best part. When the time is right, you announce an IPO and sell your company to a stock, company stock to the public and become very rich. You would make millions." "Millions, senor. Then what?" "Then you would retire and move to a small coastal fishing village. Where you would sleep late, fish a little, play with your kids, take a siesta with your wife, and stroll in the village in the evenings where you would sip wine and play guitar with your amigos." It's a pretty good point. And I think it's exactly what Jesus is talking about. I think it's exactly what this parable of the rich fool is about. It's exactly the poison that's killing our culture. And it's exactly what we need to change. Jesus wraps it up. "For all these things the nations of the world eagerly seek, but your Father knows that you need these things. But seek his kingdom, and these things will be added unto you. Let eternity weigh heavily in your life choices. Make real decisions based on relationships. On relationships being first, relationship with God first and foremost, and relationship with friends and family. Make those be the things that count in your life. Think about the time that's devoted to work versus the time devoted to relationships. You know, one thing's for sure, no one has ever gone to their deathbed wishing they just had a little less love in their lives. Never. I guarantee that. It's the one thing that matters. I'll leave you with this proverb, which I think sums it up pretty well. Proverbs 38 through 9 is a prayer to God. He says, keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food that is my portion, that I not be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. There you got Luke 12.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.